Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson in Washington. Denmark's prime minister says this weekend's attacks in Copenhagen will not change the country's embrace of free expression. Police say they have shot and killed the suspect in the shootings that bear a frightening resemblance to those in Paris last month. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from the French capital.
Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt has described the attacks a cynical act of terror. She visited Copenhagen's main synagogue on Sunday following the killing of a Jewish security guard.
Our thoughts go to his family. We are with them today. But our thoughts go to the whole of the Jewish community today. They belong in Denmark. They are a strong part of our community. And we will do everything we can to protect the Jewish community in our country.
The shootings come just over a month after the attacks at Charlie Hebdo magazine and a kosher grocery store in Paris. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The governor of Nigeria's Gombe state has imposed a 24-hour curfew in response to a Boko Haram attack on Saturday. The governor's spokesman said, although the fighting is taking place in Gombe City, the curfew takes effect across the entire state, which shares the same name. Residents, he said, are to remain indoors until further notice. The UN Security Council is considering a resolution on Yemen that would urge the Shiite Houthi rebels to step down, release ousted President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi and his cabinet, and engage in good faith peace talks to be led by the UN. Since seizing power earlier this month, the Houthis immediately dissolved parliament and set up their own ruling body. The president and his ministers remain under house arrest. On Saturday, tens of thousands of Yemenis protested against the country's takeover by the Houthis. This is VOA News. Ukrainian officials say pro-Russian rebels have shelled Ukrainian positions since the start of the ceasefire in East Ukraine, but the firing has halted along most of the front line. Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, ordered his forces to comply with the ceasefire agreed to in Minsk last week.
We strongly demand that all points of the Minsk Protocol, Minsk Memorandum, and Minsk Agreement were immediately fulfilled.
The ceasefire was reached in marathon talks between France, Germany, Ukraine, Russia, Russia-backed separatists, and the OSCE. Ukraine and a host of Western governments accuse Moscow of stoking the rebellion in the eastern portion of Ukraine by sending in arms and fighters. Moscow has repeatedly denied providing direct support to the rebels and claims the Russian troops seen fighting alongside the rebels are volunteers. A senior UN official says he sees reconciliation in war-torn Central African Republic. The head of the Africa Bureau at the UN Development Program says VOA, it is vital the international community continue to support CAR for transition toward a more stable democratic society. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UNDP's Africa Bureau chief has recently returned from a week-long visit to Central African Republic to assess what his and other UN agencies are doing to support the country's fragile peace process. He says great difficulties lie ahead for peace and reconciliation to take root as the population remains traumatized, deeply divided, and mistrustful of the state. Despite this, he says there is a sense of hope and collective willingness to revive the country's shattered communities and economy. The government is pinning its hopes for achieving a more stable, economically viable society on next month's peace-building Bangui Forum. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
2 days after the U.S. announced it was loosening import restrictions for Cuba, two senators from the United States are in Havana on a four-day trade mission to the island. Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill from the Midwestern state of Missouri arrived Saturday.
I come from a very big agricultural state. We would love to sell the Cuban people more rice. We would love to sell them more chicken and more beans and more corn. So hopefully this trip will also help my farmers at home.
And a lot more food in Cuba. With McCaskill is Senator Amy Klobuchar from the North Central state of Minnesota. The U.S. announced Friday it will allow small private Cuban businesses to sell goods and services to the U.S. except for food and agriculture products, alcohol, tobacco products, and some textiles. President Obama announced late last year that he and Cuban President Raul Castro are working together to normalize relations between the two countries. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
There is no party in this country that is well-liked and well-spread and that has performed in Nigeria like the People's Democratic Party.
Nigerian Vice President confident the ruling party will win the March 28 election.
The government has actually decided that instead of going on with conducting elections, it should postpone the election to allow for peace.
South Sudanese government seeks a constitutional amendment to extend President Salva Kiir's term in office. We'll have details.
I have spoken with the youth and I have felt less anger, although there's still deep trauma. I have seen hope from everybody to rebuild the nation.
And a top UN official sees hopeful reconciliation signs in the war-torn Central African Republic, or CAR. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian vice president has sharply denied the ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, pressured electoral chief Professor Ataero Jega to postpone the February election to March 28th. Vice President Namadi Sambo spoke with VOA's Hausa Service reporter Ibrahim Ahmed in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
No. That's totally untrue. I think it's just people that are insinuating this type of stories. PDP has no fear in any election. There is no party in this country that is well-liked and well-spread and that has performed in Nigeria, like the People's Democratic Party. You find PDP in all the 774 local governments, from the state to the local government, to the ward level, all the over 8,000 wards, you have a formation of PDP. In every ward of this country, you have a full organization of the People's Democratic Party representation. Mm-hmm. You have the party chairman, party secretary, and the complete setup of the People's Democratic Party. PDP has done well for Nigerians. PDP today, under the leadership of President Goodluck Ebele Jonathan, the Nigerian economy is the best economy in Africa. The Nigerian economy has been transformed such that there is an international report by the World Bank, even reported by the CNN, that there are the fastest growing countries, China, Qatar, and Nigeria. We are the fastest growing country. This is not by law, by accident. This is being achieved on the basis of our economic, plans and execution of our economic programs.
Mm-hmm. The main reason given for the postponement of the election was that of security. Many people, especially outside of Nigeria, are skeptical that the country will be able to deal with this security issue sufficiently to allow for elections in 6 weeks, seeing that this has been ongoing for about 6 years now.
One thing that we have said that election will take place. Mm-hmm. Our security have promised us, and they will meet it, that they will put a secure position in this country that will be able to have an election. Mm-hmm. And I want to assure everybody that we will have that election. On the 29th of May, there will be a president that will be sworn in this country. That is for sure. But keeping the issue of security aside, there are other major challenges. When INEC made presentation to us, it was very clear that 68.8 million people were registered to vote in this country. But INEC was only able to distribute 45 million out of 68 million. So 35% were shortchanged. So that 35% amounts to almost about 23, 27 million people. This number of people is more than the population of many African countries combined. So how will you imagine that such number and volume of people that are more than the population of so many countries have been shortchanged, but INEC now have the opportunity and which they are taking with the seriousness that it deserves to distribute these cards. And I believe they will distribute these cards to Nigerians. And not only that, by the time we received the reports of INEC, they confirmed that they have not been able to train properly, effectively, the officials that they are employing, ad hoc officials that they will employ to use these card readers. So this extension will give them the opportunity. They even mentioned that they can do with some time, more time, to be able to do that. And even they even mentioned in their report that they will need some additional funds. So this time will give them the opportunity, if they need more funds, to apply for the funds and to be able to do the training. They even specify that if they have time, they will be able to go to do this training on local government by local government basis. Because by the time they made the presentation of the report to us, they said they have only made one pilot test in Abuja. Yes. Out of the whole 36 states, no, nothing happened there. So really it is a blessing. And I believe INEC is one of the happiest people because now they have the opportunity to be able to conduct a very good election.
Namadi Sambo is the Nigerian vice president. He spoke with VOA Hausa Service reporter Ibrahim Ahmed from the capital, Abuja. The government of South Sudan plans to send a proposal to Parliament on Tuesday for a constitutional amendment to extend President Salva Kiir's term of office. Presidential spokesperson Atenyi Wek-Atenyi told me earlier that the cabinet also decided to postpone elections originally scheduled for June.
The government has actually decided that instead of going on with conducting elections, it should postpone the elections to allow room for peace actually to come. If it was the question of mandate, then the constitution of the Republic of South Sudan gives the current parliament the prerogative to amend the constitution and extend the lifespan of the government. So there is no worry about extension of mandate.
Doesn't this move of President Salva Kiir to have his mandate extended give his critics the ammunition to say, well, this is yet another move to show he's a dictator and now he wants to perform a constitutional coup to amend the constitution so he will stay in power? What do you say to that?
President Salva Kiir is doing this because he is responding to what international community has earlier said and advised him to do so that he allows peace to happen. And this is what he is exactly doing. President Salva Kiir was elected, and he cannot leave the power on the top of the tree. He has to wait for a certain time that the situation is better for South Sudanese in order to go for election. So see if the parliament can do that. It's not amounting to any dictatorship at all.
The proposal, I hear, is supposed to be presented to parliament on Tuesday. Wouldn't this undermine the ongoing peace talks between the government and the rebels?
Not at all. It cannot undermine the peace process. The peace process are ongoing, and then the government negotiators are on their way to Addis Ababa to attend, as the agenda of the next phase of negotiations has been supplied by the IGAD mediators. There's nothing that will undermine the peace process in this. And the president and the government, or President Salva Kiir, has made it clear that there's no alternative to peace. And this is what is going to happen. They don't interfere, because if peace is signed, peace will bring another mandate. Okay? If peace agreement is signed any time before July this year, then the arrangements will undo whatever constitutional arrangement that has been done.
So this means that the June election is off as we speak right now, based on the proposal agreed to by members of the cabinet, including the president himself, correct?
Yes, it has been agreed that the election has to be postponed and the parliament has to exercise its mandate to extend the lifespan of the government.
How long will the election be postponed, and what period of time is the president seeking his mandate to be extended?
The extension will be less than 4 years. It will be like 2 years. And as we are made to believe that elections are only conducted when there is peace in the country, as we were being criticized by the international community that we shouldn't, you know, conduct elections because part of the country was in war. So if we have accepted that, as our parliament is as a prerogative and as a right to extend the mandate of the government, that's what we have to do until the country becomes peaceful. It doesn't interfere with peace at all. So if peace agreement comes, then it will still fit within the 2 years that the parliament will be extended. The transitional government is going to the transitional national government is going to have a life of 2 years and 6 months. So it won't differ a lot.
Attorney Wek Attorney is the spokesman for the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. Meanwhile, a leading member of the rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar has condemned the government's constitutional amendment proposal. Ezekiel Lol Gatkuth told me that it will be illegal for parliament to extend President Kiir's mandate.
Of course, worldwide, this is unheard of. Because there is nobody that can extend the election anywhere in the world and give the elected president legitimacy to continue for another 2 years. Basically, this is illegal, it is unacceptable, and it is very clear that Salva, after May 21st, 2015, is not going to be an elected leader and is going to be illegitimate.
The proposal, the government believes, will be approved by Parliament to make the constitutional amendment that gives him the mandate, the legitimacy, and of course, the legal backing to stay on as the president. What is your next line of action if that were to happen?
You know, Salva Kiir and his government should be focusing on searching for peace. It is only an agreement agreed by everybody in South Sudan that let us extend or have this agreement embodied in the Constitution. And that will give the legal mandate for the transitional government of national unity to lead the people of South Sudan until the next election is held. So basically, any move which is not constitutional, because there is nothing called extending the mandate of the elected president in South Sudan in the Constitution, the transitional Constitution of South Sudan. But because we have a war in South Sudan, and because the country has split, 70% of the army is not supporting Salva Kiir. The focus should be bringing peace to this country, reunite, reconcile, and have justice and accountability for those who have committed atrocities. And then from there, an agreement which will usher this transitional government to power so that it continues to lead until the next election.
The situation is not conducive enough to hold elections in this case. So why push for elections when you know there's a conflict ongoing?
Yes, and then that is true because you cannot have elections in this country called South Sudan. Because 80% of the areas of South Sudan are at war or they are insecure to have elections. So first, the focus should be ending the war, bringing peace to the country, resettling people of South Sudan to where they were displaced. Having a government of transitional, government of national unity, so that it can reorganize this election.
Some people say that the government move would undermine the ongoing peace process. The government denies that. What is your reaction to that?
Well, basically, it is illegal. What we will tell the whole world and the people of South Sudan is that this move is illegal. We are committed to peace. The SPLM, SPLA in opposition, we are committed to peace. And we want peace to be realized. And this is what we want the Parliament of South Sudan and also Salva Kiir to focus on, bringing peace to the people of South Sudan, not extending the mandate of an illegitimate government. Because even though they are calling themselves elected leaders, they were not elected to kill people. When you are killing over 20,000 people of your own citizens, you cannot be legitimate. It's like, for example, if the United States of America, the president decided to order the killing of 20,000 people, I don't think he will still claim to be an elected leader while he's killing his own citizens. So the focus should be ending the war, bringing peace to the country. And by the way, it is very important for the AU Commission of Inquiry report to be released so that those who are held accountable for what happened, the war crimes and crimes against humanity, they should be brought to book. Now the government is advocating for the delaying of the report or deferral.
Ezekiel Lol-Gatko is a leading member of South Sudanese rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Across the continent, many leaders are trying to stay in power beyond their mandated terms. Some have even done away with term limits. So why is it difficult for some African leaders to peacefully relinquish power? Dr. Christopher Kayumba of the School of Journalism at the National University of Rwanda specializes in discerning the relationship between media, politics, development, and conflict management. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the Rwandan capital, Kigali, for his take on this issue.
I think the struggle, the difficulty of transferring power either one party to the next or from one individual to the other has four elements to it. One is the role of political violence in gaining power. And this, I think, tells us or speaks to our political culture. The political culture, I think, on the continent has been for many years such that individuals, organizations, rebel groups, you are talking about Uganda, NRM, you are talking about in DRC, Kabila, you are talking about Rwanda, you are talking about Burundi, there has been the role of the gun in gaining political power. Second, it is inorganic political systems. Inorganic political systems in a way that the political systems that we have in much of Africa are political systems adopted after colonial rule. And these political systems require rule of law, following rule of law. But as you, and this of course speaks to our political history. Before colonialism, we had the rule where, monarchical rule, where the king could never give up power until they die. So we transition from a culture where rule is forever, a king rules for forever, then we go to rule of law that requires respecting the rules. I don't think we have the culture that respects rule of law. The third point, it is the nature of the presidencies on the continent. I think presidencies on the continent are too powerful. The power that presidents hold is too powerful, such that it undermines other institutions like the legislature, like the judiciary, and you find, therefore, that the regime is directly connected to the institution that brought that government in power, and that is the military. Mm-hmm. That is why you find a man like President Museveni calling a national army, that this is my army. So the president is so powerful, it is connected to the military, and therefore that makes consent, rule of law, where power belongs to the people, extremely weak. The last point is the nature of our society. If you look at most countries on the continent, you will find that most of our people are less educated, and therefore their involvement in the issues of the state, in issues of democracy, and holding government to account is very limited.
There are those who say that all these issues we have on the continent as regards to peaceful transitions or lack thereof is because there's no culture of respecting the constitutions in those countries. Is the lack of respect for the constitution a key factor in this lack of peaceful transitions?
Actually, I would say that it is the general disrespect for the rule of law, generally. Because if it were only lack of respecting the constitution, where you have rule of law, presupposing checks and balances between institutions, that means if the chief executive or the president does not respect the constitution and wants it changed such that they can have and can stay in power as long as they want. That speaks to the political culture.
Uh-huh.
And of course, as you know, that political culture has to evolve over time.
That was Dr. Christopher Kayumba of the School of Journalism at the National University of Rwanda. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kigali. A senior United Nations official says he sees hopeful signs of reconciliation beginning to emerge in war-torn Central African Republic, or CAR. Head of the Africa Bureau at the UN Development Programme, Abdoulaye Maadie, tells VOA it is vital for the international community to maintain support for CAR as it enters a critical period of transition toward a more stable democratic society. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UNDP's Africa Bureau chief has recently returned from a week-long visit to Central African Republic to assess what his and other UN agencies are doing to support the country's fragile peace process. He says great difficulties lie ahead for peace and reconciliation to take root as the population remains traumatized, deeply divided, and mistrustful of the state. Despite this, he says there is a sense of hope and collective willingness to revive the country's shattered communities and economy.
But the country is coming a long way. I have seen, as I said earlier, some green shoots in peace and security. I have seen the economy starting slowly to revive itself. I have spoken with the youth, and I have felt less anger, although there is still deep trauma. I have seen hope from everybody to rebuild the nation. This is very important.
The government is pinning its hopes for achieving a more stable, economically viable society on next month's peace-building Bangui Forum. This national gathering will prepare the ground for the planned constitutional referendum, as well as legislative and presidential elections scheduled for August. Its longer-term aim is to start a reconciliation process for all levels of society. Thousands of people have been killed since December 2012, when the mainly Muslim Seleka rebels launched attacks to overthrow the government of François Bozizé. The United Nations estimates the conflict has uprooted more than 438,000 people within the CAR and forced more than 423,000 others to flee to neighboring countries. The formation of the Christian anti-Balaka militia has increased the sectarian nature of the conflict, creating a religious divide in a country where this did not formally exist. Dieh says there is no Muslim-Christian crisis in the country. He says religion has been manipulated by political leaders for opportunistic reasons and ultimately will have no sway over the population.
Population have been living side to side, and a lot of inter-religion marriages are there. And these pre-consultations leading to the Forum of Bangui have been a great therapy to bring this nation together. And I'm convinced that when they go to the Bangui Forum, the therapy will be even deeper, and that will open the ground for recovery and development for this nation, and they deserve it.
Dieh says eradicating exclusion and rebuilding the country's economy is key to ending the violence in CAR. He says the country's development prospects hinge on restoring security, creating a strong state authority, and including all segments of society, in particular young people and women. In the meantime, he notes more than half of the country's population of 4.9 million is in need of emergency assistance. Therefore, he says, it is crucial for the international community to continue its financial support for this potentially rich but currently impoverished country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva. We'll be right back.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria, Lagos, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, February 15th. The 2015 Africa Cup of Nations has come and gone, but the fallouts of Africa's Premier Football Tournament continue to reverberate. First, the sanctions imposed on Morocco for withdrawing as the original host due to Ebola fears. African soccer's governing body, CAF, banned the North African country from the next two editions of the tournaments in 2017 and 2019. The Royal Moroccan Football Federation, FRMF, was also fined $1 million, another to pay another $9.12 million in damages to CAF and its partners. After Morocco's withdrawal in November 2014, Equatorial Guinea came on as emergency hosts, saving the tournament. Well, Morocco has rejected all the sanctions, saying there is no regulatory basis for the punishments. The Moroccan Federation said it will, quote, take all necessary measures to uphold the rights and interests of Moroccan football and provisions, unquote. But are the sanctions against Morocco strong enough to prevent future host nations from behaving like the North African country? That was the question I put to Segun Adebike, a former editor-in-chief of the News Agency of Nigeria and a football enthusiast.
Yes, I think so. Close to $1 million, and then another $9 million for as reparation, as it were. Is it? Imagine what would have happened, what disgrace Africa would have faced if Equatorial Guinea didn't come to CAF's aid. So, I think, going by that, the sanctions are okay. Let Morocco stay out of the championship for two times, and then that will serve as a deterrent. I believe other nations won't do that.
How do you see the tournament in Equatorial Guinea, considering that Equatorial Guinea had to be an emergency host?
I think they did their best, given the short time they had to prepare. Initially, there were complaints about inadequate hotel rooms, inadequate transportation, but as the tournament wore on, all those problems were forgotten and people concentrated on the football. And I think Equatorial Guinea deserves the commendation for preventing this shame to Africa.
That was Segun Adebike, a former editor-in-chief of the News Agency of Nigeria. He spoke with me right here in Lagos. In more fallout from the 2015 Nations Cup, Equatorial Guinea President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbasogo has pardoned 149 people who were arrested following clashes during the Africa Cup of Nations semi-final between the host nation and Ghana. Martin Gundongo Sue, President of Malabo Supreme Court, confirmed on Friday that all those arrested have been released. We were ready to go to trial for you to be punished. But the President of the Republic, Teodoro Obiang, in his role as the Chief Magistrate of the nation and father of all of you, has forgiven you and you are free, Ndongo Sue told the accused before they were released to their families in front of the Supreme Court. President Mbasogo had blasted what he called the childish behavior of Equatorial Guinea fans who turned on Ghanaian supporters, pelting them with plastic bottles and chairs and leaving 36 injured. The 2015 Nations Cup host was fined $100,000 by CAF and ordered to play a match behind closed doors. Now, with the Nations Cup over, it is the turn of Africa's two football club competitions, the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup. The preliminary rounds of the two competitions started across Africa this weekend. First, the Champions League. Some 50 teams are featuring in the preliminary round to be played on home and away basis between February 13th and March 1st. The 25 aggregate winners will advance to the first round, where they will be joined by the seven teams that drew a bye into that round. The first round will be played between March 13th and April 5th. The 16 aggregate winners will then advance to the second round, to be played between April 17th and May 3rd. The 8 aggregate winners will qualify for the group stage, the date of which is yet to be determined. Meanwhile, it was a bittersweet start for Moroccan representatives Maghreb Tetouan and Raja Athletic Club in the first leg matches of the preliminary round. Tetouan suffered a 2-0 loss in Bamako to Malian side club Olympique de Bamako. For its part, Raja, three-time winner of the Premier Continental Club Championship, crushed visiting the Ablaise Noirs of Congo 4-0 in Casablanca. In Tunis, Ali Tripoli of Libya beat Egyptian debutant Smouha 1-0. Turning to the CAF Confederation Cup, 46 teams are engaged in the preliminary round, being played between February 13th and March 1st. The 23 aggregate winners will join the 9 teams that drew a bye into the first round, to be played from March 13th to April 5th. The 16 aggregate winners from the first round will advance to the second round, to be played from April 17th to May 3rd. The 8 aggregate winners will then be drawn against the 8 losers from the second round of the CAF Champions League for a playoff. The winners of the playoff will advance to the group stage. In other news, World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, doesn't like the choice of Manaus as a football host city for the 2016 Olympics in Brazil. FIFA says it prefers games to be played at venues closer to Game Center in Rio de Janeiro, and that Manaus is not a suitable first option for a hosting venue. FIFA's statement came a day after the Olympic organizers announced that they were adding Manaus to the list of proposed host cities to integrate all of Brazil into the games. The city is about 3,000 kilometers from Rio in the Amazon jungle. The other proposed venues beside Rio are Sao Paulo, Belo Horizonte, Salvador, and Brasilia. All of them hosted matches during last year's World Cup. Finally, has the richest matchup in boxing history between Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao been finally agreed? The answer depends on whom you believe. The London Telegraph newspaper reported on Sunday that the Filipino boxer completed his contractual agreements on Saturday, and that Mayweather is set to sign in the coming days. Manny has 100% signed his side of the deal, the paper reported. It is now over to Mayweather to close the deal and announce the fight. But Showtime Sports boxing executive Steven Espinosa says no deal has been signed. Not sure what anyone is signing, since no agreement has been finalized yet, Espinosa said on his Twitter account. The mega fights between the pair of welterweight world champions is expected to shatter all boxing's box office records. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Clotty in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Well, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Voici maintenant comment les sous-sous, les malinqués, les forestiers, les peuls s'amusent. Explique-moi, c'est un peu d'idée qui est beau.
Allez, coule le casque et son corps. Corinandoma, comment on fait la yada de bouter. On y va, manique de ses son corps. Allez, fou calama, panamara, mon y chauffé. Allez, ici de ses son corps. Allez, rouillen, 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 bébé, bouter. Allez, nous sommes de ses son corps. Il ne veut, il ne veut, il ne veut, je te dis qu'il ne veut.
Et en fait, sans mentir, je suis sans beaucoup. La nuit venue, je glisse chez toi. Sans bruit, je te lâche d'un coup. Je fuis partout, dans tous tes trous. Mon gars, je suis Nintendo. La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu, je veux le feu sans beaucoup.
La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu, je veux le feu sans beaucoup.
La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu.
Le commissaire ou le procureur, parce qu'il m'aime bien et il m'adore. La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu, je veux le feu sans beaucoup.
La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu, je veux le feu sans beaucoup.
La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu, je veux le feu sans beaucoup.
La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu, je veux le feu sans beaucoup.
La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu, je veux le feu sans beaucoup.
La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu, je veux le feu sans beaucoup.
La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je veux le feu, je veux le feu sans beaucoup.
La nuit, mon gars, je suis sans beaucoup.
Je dis l'homme ne passe pas là. Oh, l'homme ne passe pas là, mais. Oh, l'homme ne passe pas là. Oh, l'homme ne passe pas là, mais.
Three.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In the context of what transpired in the South African Parliament in Cape Town last Thursday, when President Jacob Zuma's State of the Nation address was frequently interrupted or, in fact, heckled, many senior leaders of the African National Congress, ANC, must have rued the day in 2012 when they finally decided to expel Julius Malema, the former youth leader of the ANC, from the party. It was not a unanimous decision. There were dissenting voices in the party that cautioned that it would be far more prudent to keep him and his followers in the party with the aim of tutoring them about the inevitable constraints of governance. Perhaps the majority of the leadership were carried away by the fact that Julius Malema, who had managed to annoy many in all sectors of society, had a very bad press in South Africa. In their view, he was the firebrand that should be silenced for all times. Good riddance was the unanimous consensus in the South African media. But Julius Malema would not go away without a fight. And outside the elite media and groups, he was amazingly popular. The issue he has always raised about corruption, the need to resolve the land problems in favor of the black population, and his constant call for the nationalization of the mines resonated with the youth, the poor, and the mining unions. After his expulsion in 2012, although there were many allegations of fraud against him, he hastily formed his own party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, that focused on the rights of the poor. In the May 2014 general election, his party managed to win 6% of the votes and 25 members of parliament. With his new platform in parliament, the party EFF gave immediate notice that its members would be unconventional in parliament. Parliamentary formalities and rules of procedures and conduct were viewed by Julius Malema as clever devices to prevent parliamentarians from getting to the bottom of issues. Although Julius Malema was once seen as the blue-eyed boy of President Jacob Zuma, there was a public falling out. It should be recalled that Julius Malema stood shoulder to shoulder with President Zuma in his political contest with former President Mbeki. Now in parliament, Julius Malema saw President Zuma as his number one political enemy. And this factor should help explain what occurred in Parliament last Thursday. In fact, everything was telegraphed even before Parliament was convened. Julius Malema stated that he would ask the president when he would pay the money he used to furnish his private home. In a sense, nothing was a surprise, except the extent of the chaos and scuffling which occurred last Thursday in Parliament. It was widely thought to be an embarrassment to the South Africans. It is clear that the ruling party, the ANC, was well prepared for the confrontation with Julius Malema and his party in Parliament. But the actions that they contemplated was a surprise. For some clearly unknown reasons, the signal on mobile phones were blocked. Hence, the call, bring back the signals. The other action was much more serious. The EFF parliamentarians, having failed to heed the pleas of the speaker, were asked to leave the chamber. When they refused, the protection officers of parliament and the armed security officers were called in to remove them. The EFF members were dragged out of the building, and the main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, walked out. Any student of British parliamentary history would point out that sending armed men to arrest parliamentarians could be dangerous and fatal. When King Charles I took the unprecedented step to go personally to Parliament with armed guards to arrest five recalcitrant parliamentarians as he saw them, he escalated the struggle with Parliament. Since that day of 4 January 1642, no English monarch has been allowed to enter the House of Commons. In the end, the continuation of Charles's struggle with Parliament led to him being taken to the scaffold. But historians will always remember what he said when he did not find the five parliamentarians in Parliament. His remarks were, "The birds have flown." I thank you.
And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Adeyemi, and our engineer for today, Brian Makulie, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders in Cameroon say, no matter how drunk a rat is, he doesn't go to sleep in a cat's bed. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria's Election Commission has postponed the nation's closely watched presidential election for 6 weeks, citing security concerns over the insurgent group Boko Haram's continued attacks in areas of northeast Nigeria. Once set for February 14th, voting will now be held March 28th, as combined operations of troops from Chad, Cameroon, and Nigeria work to reclaim and pacify areas of the country taken over by the insurgents, bent on creating an Islamic State. Despite security concerns, the move brought charges of political interference by the government and sparked fears of political unrest in the hotly contested race. Opposition leaders have called for calm to discourage the kind of violence that marred the voting in 2011. The United States joins others in the international community in voicing deep disappointment in the Election Commission's decision to postpone the election. Any political interference with the Independent National Electoral Commission is unacceptable, and it is critical that the government not use security concerns as a pretext for impeding the democratic process. Given the stakes, it's absolutely critical that these elections be conducted peacefully and that they are credible, transparent, and accountable. That way, the people of Nigeria can have faith, and the world can have faith in the government that flows from it. The international community will be watching closely as the Nigerian government prepares for elections on the newly scheduled dates. The United States underscores the importance of ensuring that there are no further delays. We support a free, transparent, and credible electoral process in Nigeria and renew our calls on all candidates, their supporters, and Nigerian citizens to maintain calm and reject election-related violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.